Good afternoon. Let's get it started. In this track, we will have two presentations, and the first one will be 15 minutes. The second one is 30 minutes. And after that, we will take a short break for 10 minutes. It's shorter than the coffee break in the other days. So after the 10 minutes short break, and we will all gather together for the final summary panel discussion. Okay. So our first speaker is Joshua Hill, and he is an information security scientist from InfoGuard Laboratories. He will talk about an approach for entropy assessment of ring oscillator-based noise sources. Joshua, please welcome Joshua.
All right, hello everyone. So a few notes. I think it's maybe useful to wear my heart on my sleeve, as it were, and sort of introduce why it is I'm interested in sort of talking about this. So in the evaluation of noise and entropy sources and various sort of certification venues, there's oftentimes a strong push against some sort of notion of acceptance of a model-based approach for estimating entropy. And so, for example, a standard way that you see entropy being estimated, for example, in FIPS 140 has quite a lot to do with statistical testing. I guess I'd like to suggest that, and that's done oftentimes because models are thought to be extremely hard to construct. And so what I'd like to do is present a model for ring oscillators, show you that it's at least reasonably straightforward and fairly straightforward to analyze. There's a lot of complexity underlying some of these things, but some of it you can end up sidestepping. And so I think that's more or less what I'm interested in chatting about. This whole thing will be quite informal. If you have questions as they occur to you, please feel free to interrupt. In particular, I'm interested in trying to convey how these things work. I will provide somewhat of a warning, I guess, for example, if you had an undergraduate calculus class and that inspired a great deal of anxiety, there's maybe a slight math warning ahead. But I'll try and explain where these things come from. You're not going to be expected to do these various calculations by hand. There is not going to be a quiz at the end of the talk. So, you know, this is more or less just a formal way of presenting how some of these things work out. Okay, well, as hopefully we're all aware, we need randomness for a lot of cryptographic systems. And fundamentally, the reason for this is sort of game theoretic in nature. A fairly standard assumption in evaluating the security of cryptographic systems is Kirchhoff's principle, where we assume that an adversary knows more or less everything there is to know about the design other than the keys. And so in particular, they know how keys are selected. And so with that assumption in mind, game theory tells us that actually the best way to actually select keys, if an attacker knows how you select keys, is to select them at random. But of course, selecting them at random requires some source of uncertainty. So in particular, for this talk, what I'm going to try and do is present a model-oriented way to assess the entropy production for noise sources. The particular thing that I'm interested in looking at is ring oscillators. So ring oscillators are interesting for a whole lot of reasons. One of the main reasons is perhaps that they're so common. It's sort of the hardware and sort of the hardware industry's equivalent of a Hello World program. It's the sort of thing that in a new process, you might look at how ring oscillators work, look at their general characteristics, and that gives you some insight as to how the process as a whole is working. And so it's not very surprising that upon being interested in, needing some uncertainty, something like ring oscillator sort of springs to mind because there's sort of a reasonable and long history of assessing how much uncertainty there is associated with these things. So in this case, we're going to take an odd number of inverters. And as it turns out, as long as you have an odd number of inverters, there could be any number of other buffers in there. But we're going to arrange them into a loop. So at the tail end, it's going to loop back into the start. So for our purpose today, I'm making a whole bunch of simplifying assumptions. I'm not really that interested in talking about how these things are initialized. As it turns out, these sort of circuits, even if they're not explicitly initialized, enter into sort of spontaneous oscillation on power up. So as soon as power reaches a certain point, they start spontaneously oscillating. And so that's a pretty common way of going about it. It's also not terribly unheard of to actually explicitly initialize these things so that you actually know roughly what the phase looks like, particularly in the instance that you have multiple phase that you're looking at. So we're going to arrange these things in a loop. I've got some labeled value Q. That's going to be the output of this thing, and that's where we're going to sample. There's a whole lot of complexity on sampling these things as well, and I'm going to be completely blasé about that. You're oftentimes going to be sampling these things through one or multiple latches in order to assure that things are relatively stable. And then there's a lot of ways of combining these things, but we'll get into a little bit of that later. For the most part, what we're going to be looking at today is really just a single oscillator sampled periodically. And in this case, it's going to be sampled at the frequency f sub s. So the general notion as to why these things oscillate, so each one of these logic gates is going to have some expected propagation delay. That is to say, the time in between when the logic value on input changes, and you know, if we actually think about reality, that there's going to be some continuum. It's not necessarily a logic 1 or a logic 0. There's some voltage swing. But again, I'm going to be largely abstracting this at the moment. When it actually changes, the amount of time that it takes from the change to propagate forward and for the logic gate to actually invert. So that propagation delay establishes the nominal frequency of these. And again, you'll notice that I'm maybe overlooking the notion of how these various things are routed, et cetera. These all play into this quite a lot. For our purpose, again, today I'm mainly going to just sort of assert that ultimately there's some delay. It establishes a particular, in this case, ring oscillator period. Of course, you could be more interested in the frequency. These are basically interchangeable as long as you remember to invert at the appropriate times. But for our purpose today, I'm interested in its period. So variations on the per gate expected propagation delay, which is called jitter, comes from a superposition of actually a variety of sources. There's the bit that we're interested in, which is the local Gaussian thermal noise. There's a whole bunch of other noise as well that sort of plays into this and that affects it quite a lot. So some examples of this would be local deterministic switching noise having to do with surrounding structures inside the same package. And there's also global noise that would include things like power supply noise, electromagnetic emanations external to the device, etc. There's a whole lot of things that induce jitter. We're only interested in a relatively small subset of this, or at least what in a lot of designs end up being a fairly small subset of this, which is specifically the local Gaussian thermal noise. Toward the tail end of this talk, I'll try and give a notion as to how to actually gain some insight as to what component of your observed jitter is as actually associated with this. But suffice to say, that's mainly what we're going to be interested in. Okay, so for our purpose, we're interested in the local Gaussian thermal noise because it's the source that is difficult for an informed active attacker to it's difficult for them to predict or have any undue influence on. Now, because I'm operating under Kirchhoff's principle, I'm sort of operating under the assumption that the attacker knows more than is probably reasonable in almost any attack, other than perhaps a substantial state actor or an insider attack. I'm assuming that all of the actual details of these things are known, and when I say all of them, I mean everything except for the entropy source itself. And in fact, you'll see later on we make other assumptions that make the actual attacker almost, not quite all powerful, but more powerful than you would expect from your sort of standard attacker. And the reason is that as long as you can bound what such an attacker would know, then you can actually say, well, this style of attacker can gain this amount of information about this, and so the amount of uncertainty with respect to that attacker is probably going to be a better situation than the actual attackers that you really encounter. And that's, the basic notion that we're operating here. Okay, so as the name local Gaussian thermal noise suggests, that the jitter associated with this has a normal distribution. This component of the jitter is expected to be independent from gate to gate. The global noise and some local switching noise is not independent from gate to gate. And what that tells you is that ultimately observed jitter, so for example, if you directly measure jitter associated with a ring oscillator, you're actually, because you're looking at the superposition of a number of effects, there's a very real chance that you're going to sort of over-characterize the bit of the jitter that you're sort of interested in. So that's something to sort of bear in mind as you're sort of going through this analysis. You know, if you actually hook these things up to an oscilloscope and actually directly measure some sort of notion of standard deviation of jitter, that's not necessarily going to be the exact value that you want to proceed with. Okay, well, we've just said that the jitter for each one of these gates is independent and normal. When you sum a set of independent, normally distributed random variables, you're going to get something that's normal. So it's going to be another Gaussian distribution. Because of the way we constructed this, we're sort of asserting that the jitter is variation from the mean, and so from the mean period length. And so one of the consequences of that is that the jitter is sort of almost by definition going to have a mean of zero, and then it'll have a standard deviation that's going to be dependent upon, the standard deviation of all of the gates that it's actually proceeding through. Okay, so today we're just going to simplify, and as I said, there's a lot of things that influence this, but what we're going to be doing is keeping track of the local Gaussian normal noise in induced jitter on a per cycle basis, and this jitter is going to be normally distributed with mean zero variance sigma squared. We have to call it something, so that's what we're calling it. We're going to freely go back and forth between variance and standard deviation. I'll sort of mention that now. It's really the only difference is one is the square root of the other, so it's not going to be that interesting. And that'll be pretty obvious from just the notation as we proceed. Okay, so some interesting things associated with ring oscillators. So ring oscillators are commonly very temperature and voltage sensitive. In fact, it's pretty common for the underlying elements of the ring oscillator to be voltage controlled. That is to say, the frequency of the ring oscillator ultimately ends up being a direct consequence of whatever voltage you're feeding it with, which means that parameter, the voltage, is going to have a really substantial impact on the actual, all of the system characteristics. Similarly, the temperature, as you change your physical constants in the piece of silicon, is going to slide all over the place. And so, as a result, these things are very environmentally sensitive. Now, when not under an attack, these things actually have a sort of self-righting property about them. They tend to seek a particular value, and there's a bit of feedback that makes it so that they tend to restore to some sort of nominal frequency. But that's in the absence of an attack. If you're interested in dealing with the case where an attacker has access to it, if an attacker has physically submerged this thing in liquid nitrogen, then fundamentally the physical constants are going to shift radically. And so one of the characterizations that we're going to have to do on this is to come up with some notion of an attack model, which part of it is going to be a matter of, hey, where are we going to be operating in temperature-wise, and where are we going to be operating voltage-wise? And that's going to give us a family of parameters, and we're more or less going to have to choose the value in that family of parameters that gives us the lowest entropy assessment. That gives us a worst case. Okay, so what we've said so far is we've got ring oscillators. We've asserted that there's some uncertainty there. I think more or less anyone who's ever dealt with these things would assert, yes, there's some uncertainty, definitely. And so then the question is, well, how do we proceed? And so let's look at a rough draft. And when I say rough draft, this actually bears some resemblance to how things in like an evaluation scheme might work today. So, hey, step one, get some ring oscillators. Step two, we'll assess their entropy production through, let's say, statistical testing. Step three, entropy. Hot diggity. There we go. So, obviously, problem solved. I'm glad everyone showed up. I have some time left, it looks like, so, open that to questions. So the question at this point is, well, what can we do, and what have we actually solved at this point? All I've asserted is, well, there's some uncertainty here, but I haven't really characterized it. So in addition, we haven't really talked about how to, we've said we're very interested in this sort of local Gaussian noise that induces some jitter, but I haven't really told you how to assess that. And so the best you can do right now is assess the actual bulk jitter properties and kind of go with that. And then there's the slight problem that statistical testing largely doesn't work with ring oscillators. So minor issue. Let's talk about that last point just a little bit. So as it turns out, depending upon what the various system parameters are, and we'll introduce these system parameters as we proceed forward, but depending upon what you've chosen, there's a goodly chance that your oscillators have output that is actually principally deterministic. There's probably some non-determinism in there somewhere, but the notion that you're going to sample your ring oscillator, which is in some sense at its base a periodic thing, with another periodic thing, I mean, you should kind of note that there's some interactions here, and I don't expect necessarily the result of periodic sampling of a principally periodic thing to be chock full of randomness by design. And so we're interested in being able to assess that somehow. Well, there are some mechanisms you can use. So for example, you can use an autocorrelation test to determine what basically single oscillators look like, but that doesn't actually provide you with an easy entropy bound. When I say that an easy entropy bound, if you've actually read this paper, you know that in fact you can use this autocorrelation test to come up with some sort of most likely estimator, and which is like this two-dimensional surface. You get lots and lots of data, and eventually you come up to this like, oh, hopefully it converges to a point, and you say, well, great, here's the most likely, you know, my estimator sort of suggests this is likely the parameter set, and you can kind of base it upon that. But as it turns out, that's an extensive process, and not the sort of thing you're just going to have pop out of your normal statistical test. It involves humans looking at the thing and trying to figure out how these things are proceeding. So it isn't a statistical test that just pops out a number, I guess, is my point. And then in addition, a standard way of dealing with these things is you have not just a single ring oscillator, but maybe you have multiple ring oscillators. Each one of these ring oscillators has maybe a different period. Maybe these things are, you know, basically, if you're basing them upon the same style of thing, you have some notion of maybe coprimeness, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then the question is, you take these things, you maybe XOR them together, something nice and simple like that, and then the question is, well, what does that look like? And the answer is, oh, well, that looks spectacular. And so you think, oh, you know, great, looks spectacular. But in fact, looks spectacular irrespective of whether there's any uncertainty. So as it turns out, you take a relatively small number of these things, on the order of like 18-ish, as it turns out. You take these things, you run them, you XOR them together, and the output basically passes statistical tests, irrespective of any jitter. So you can do these things in simulation, and in simulation you just say, oh, okay, well, let's set the jitter to literally zero. We're going to have a wholly deterministic set of things here, so there is zero entropy in this system, zero. And then we're going to pass it through some statistical tests, and what do they tell us? They tell us it's like full entropy. Well, great. That sounds like we're pretty much done again. I mean, step one, I said, hey, there's uncertainty. Step two, perfect statistics. And so it's sort of like literally you could all be driving for the door at this point because I've effectively said that, you know, hey, it's going to assess basically perfectly with, say, with respect to the SP890B testing, you know, all that great statistical testing. It's going to be basically perfect, but with zero entropy. So, you know, if you're actually concerned about the security, then maybe you should hang around for a little bit longer. So what it comes down to is statistical testing of these things, particularly if you combine them in any non-trivial, even in trivial ways, basically XOR is pretty much trivial, it looks pretty much perfect. If you combine them in slightly less trivial ways, like LFSRs, through cryptographic hashing functions, whatever, whatever, it's going to look even better. I mean, you know, it's like almost nothing you feed into these things is going to look bad. They could have all failed, it could be wholly deterministic, and effectively all you're testing with a statistical test is, basically, is my LFSR still functioning, is more or less what your stats test tells you. And that's it. Okay, so those don't work, at least not if you care about what the actual entropy or security of your system is. So what might work? And what I'm suggesting is, in this sort of situation, since statistical testing isn't going to do it for us, what are we left with? And the answer is, well, we can try and build some sort of model that tells us how in general these things are working, and that actually gives us some notion as to how we can proceed. And so we'll proceed using a model that's very similar to a paper by Sonar et al. I have references at the tail end here, so I advise you to look at all these, they're great papers. We make a lot of simplifying assumptions that make our attacker like almost omniscient. So we assume that there's no uncertainty associated with when the cycle starts, that the global elements of jitter and the deterministic elements of jitter are totally known to the attacker. And so we only credit uncertainty associated with local Gaussian thermal noise that has accrued since the last time we sampled. So notably, when we sample, we assume that our sampling has somehow informed the attacker of precisely what the state of the RNG is, which is a profoundly powerful attacker, surely. But we do have to continue to assume that the attacker doesn't necessarily know that we sampled them. So there are limits to the omniscience of our attacker, we think. But suffice to say, we're not really accounting for any sort of long-term accrual of jitter in this sort of model. All right. So in addition, as we've already said, the output of these things looks pretty much fantastic, even in the absence of jitter. And so what we're going to do instead of tracking the literal output is we're actually going to look for deviations from the known deterministic output. So that's more or less what we're going to be tracking. So in a little bit, when we start talking about most likely symbols and things like that, the most likely symbol is the expected deterministic output. We don't necessarily, for our analysis, have to care what that value is. What we have to care is it the deterministic value or is it not the deterministic value? And those are our two symbols that we'll be tracking. All right. The underlying distribution depends upon the number of oscillator cycles that have happened since the last time we sampled. Remember, we could possibly accrue uncertainty as long as we haven't sampled. And so the number of these is going to be expressed by this value. It has to do with the period and the frequency that we're sampling at. Okay, so we're going to call that, and then we're going to call the standard deviation that we end up getting from that, we're going to call it delta. It's going to be in terms of whatever the per cycle standard deviation is, and it's going to involve how many different times it's actually gone around since our last cycle. So it's all fairly straightforward. It's expressed here in impenetrable math, but all I'm saying is, look, how many times has it gone around since our last sample? Take the square root of that thing, multiply by the standard deviation, and what you've got is now the standard deviation of what you expect at the tail end of this whole thing with your samples. Okay, well, welcome to calculus. I guess this would be roughly second quarter. So here we are. This is your standard normal distribution. I just want to remind you, or if you don't recall this information, tell you. We're going to be interested in principally in something called the cumulative distribution function of the normal distribution. And so what we have here is a bell curve. What we're interested in for the CDF is going to be just what the probability of something being smaller than this value. So what we have here is, this is our cutoff, and we're interested in just integrating. So we've got this area here. As it turns out, that's this garbage, but everyone can put your pencils down. As I said, no quiz. This is more or less stuff you can look up on Wikipedia. This is standard, the standard CDF associated with our particular process where the standard deviation is delta. Okay, so here we have a freakishly idealized waveform, which probably won't resemble what your actual oscillator looks like, but for the purpose of our discussion right now, I just want to make this as clear as possible what's going on. So what we've got here is we're going to make an underlying assumption here, which for most designs is not terribly unreasonable. We're going to assume that the accumulated jitter between samples ends up being less than half the length of the period, and you'll see why we end up having to make that assumption. I'd like to point out that if you're at time one, where are we? Right there. Then what that means is the probability of outputting a one, that is to say a non-deterministic output, rather than a zero, which is the expected deterministic output, is the same as the probability that the jitter is going to be less than T1. So you can express that in terms of the CDF. So that's just literally the particular CDF we put together at T1. Very straightforward. On the right-hand side of this whole mess, what we see is that instead of using the CDF, we have to use the complementary CDF because the probability of a non-deterministic output happens to be, the probability that it's going to be larger than that value, not less than that value. So you need the complementary CDF. Great. So at least we know if we sampled at a particular time, we actually know how to account for that min entropy because we know what the probability of the most likely output is. And we can just calculate that using the CDF. Okay, well, we're not going to stop there. Instead, what we're going to do is we actually need to say, I'm interested in saying, well, if I don't know precisely when I sampled, just how much could I expect? And so what we're going to do is we're going to subdivide this waveform into k different buckets. And then, as it turns out, we're going to look at we're going to look at a bound, which provides effectively the least min entropy within this bucket. So the way this works out is if you're using a non-center bucket, the expected deterministic output is the most likely symbol. In the center, well, so center bucket, it's sort of irrelevant, so we can ignore that. The center bucket, as it turns out, it could go either way. So if you happen to be on the left-hand side of this, the maximal probability of a deterministic output, which is corresponds to the smallest min entropy, is obtained by choosing the left-hand edge. And if you're on the other side of the graph, it's obtained by just choosing the right-hand edge. So, great. So I'll point out that what we're going to do fairly straightforwardly is just say, well, fine, choose the right-hand, left-hand edges. Here we're making another interesting assumption. We're going to assume that we actually choose which bucket we're getting the value from uniformly at random, which seems like a very strange assumption. I'm basically assuming that there's some underlying random process that establishes when I sample. And I guess on a sample by sample basis, that's maybe not the best assumption. In fact, surely not. However, over time, on average, you will have explored all of these values, assuming you don't have some sort of weird integer relationship or relatively small rational relationship in between your sampling clock and your actual oscillators. And so the notion is that as long as there's not a really tight coupling between these two things, you should explore all the various buckets. And in fact, as a portion of our analysis when we use this, we actually do some probabilistic modeling to make sure that's a reasonable assumption. But it makes sense in most designs as an average case. So as it turns out, you can then bound the probability of a deterministic output. And this is horrible, I admit, but what it comes down to is this accounts for the left-hand side of that graph we saw, and it's basically just choosing the left-hand edge. This accounts for the right-hand side of that graph we just saw, and it's choosing the right-hand edge. There's a whole bunch of garbage here that if you find a calculus student who's just gone through second quarter calculus and learned about Riemann sums, they'll be able to explain quite clearly where all this stuff is coming from. It's literally just choosing the left or right-hand edge. That's it. It is a Riemann sum. And so what that tells us is as we increase the number of buckets, this looks more and more like an integral. And what this does is provide us with a bound. And this integral looks like this. That's not the value that we're actually going to use, because as it turns out, that's really operating, you're sort of assuming that's the hardest to justify choice in some sense. By choosing the low number of buckets, you're discarding a whole bunch of entropy. By choosing a very high number of buckets, you're making the bucket is chosen uniformly at random claim harder to actually verify as true. And so it ends up being some sort of dynamic tension. You want to choose some finite number of buckets, and it turns out that it doesn't really actually matter so much what that value is. We'll see that in the next slide, as long as it's eventually pretty high. I mean, for sort of signs we've seen, it's like on the order of 1,000 buckets or so is what we look at. Okay. So when I said that it sort of doesn't matter, this is one particular design. What you have here is the log base 2 of the number of buckets down here. And as that increases, you see that this sort of asymptotically goes up to the value at the very top, which is the value the integral sticks out. So the fact that the integral exists, the fact that we know what that integral is, tells us we can actually assess what percentage of the entropy we've actually gathered in some sense. So for our evaluations, we actually say, well, okay, we'll just look for 90 some odd percent, like 99%, 95%, whatever. And that's going to be the cutoff we want. We can just figure out how many buckets we need for that. And then we do our statistical testing based upon that, just to make sure sort of this model is not an unreasonable thing to do. Okay. So Now we're on to our next task. This is what we do once we actually know what our system parameters are, but how do we figure out what our system parameters are? Well, some of these are very straightforward. The nominal period is just gonna be related to the frequency. These are very easy to assess. You just do long-term calculations or long-term estimates. You wanna do these in a variety, well, all of these measurements in a variety of environmental conditions, but fundamentally, the frequency is easy. The cycle, so, but direct measurement of cycle times, if that's how you're gonna actually try and assess what your standard deviation is, can be a little bit touchy. If you do it internally, that is to say you have some circuitry that actually is co-located with the actual ring oscillator that is some sort of, say, very fast running but stable timer and you've managed to count, then, I mean, that's one way of proceeding. You can also have it measure this sort of thing externally, you know, standard sort of oscilloscope sort of situation. But in that instance, you have to watch out for whether you've introduced extra jitter as a consequence of your sampling. So another option is to produce these ring oscillators in sort of matched pairs and then subtract the measurement. And so when I say matched pairs, I mean literally the individual elements of these ring oscillators should be very, very close to each other. And what that does is it makes it so that if one of these ring oscillators experiences noise, then the other one experiences very similar noise. And then at the tail end, you subtract. As it turns out, by assumption, the underlying noise associated with the local thermal noise is going to be distinct and independent, but everything else is the global noise is surely, well, by definition, global, and even the local switching noise can actually be canceled out in this way, some of local switching noise. You would have to correct for variance if you're going to do this, but it's pretty straightforward. As it turns out, you can use this very similar technique to this. And actually trigger the sampling of one of the ring oscillators using the other ring oscillator. And that gives you a fairly easy to analyze condition as well, which we're not really talking about. That's not the model we're using today. But there's some interesting academic papers on that. All right. These measurements, as I mentioned, have to be taken across all the supported environmental temperature and voltage ranges. And then you use the smallest measure of jitter standard deviation. In fact, really what you should be doing is you should be thinking about these in pairs, the nominal period and the standard deviation, and then plugging each one of these into a model and really selecting the one that gives you the smallest bound on min entropy. It's also possible, and a very interesting approach, to do direct continuous measurement of the variance. And when I say that, I mean like literally the ring oscillator has a subcomponent or has a portion of the circuit that itself tries to directly assess what the standard deviation of that ring oscillator is and making sure that it stays reasonably consistent. And again, there's a nice paper reference here. Okay, so that's the model. So basically we're done. I didn't really describe like how one does this. You've seen a whole bunch of integrals and that may give you a sense of unfortunateness and make you think, well, I'm gonna have to calculate all this by hand. But as it turns out, we've got computers and computers are fabulous at doing these things. All of these integrals are, as it turns out, don't have closed form solutions anyway. So you're left with a numerical approximation. It's extremely straightforward just to take any computer algebra system that you can download for free or you can pay a company several thousand dollars and have a computer algebra system that does all these things very straightforwardly and quite accurately. Okay, but what I'd like to do now is sort of review our assumptions. And so the assumptions that we made are important for a few reasons. It really sort of informed the model we were using and told us, you know, how we should do some certain things. And also, it's the sort of thing that I think really ought to be tracked and explicitly reported in when talking about these models. And the reason is that as validation and certification agencies, groups, programs proceed forward, they should really track what assumptions they think are reasonable to make. And that should be rather explicit. So, for example, one assumption that we aren't making here but would be possible to make is, I assume that all jitter that I've measured is necessarily due to local Gaussian noise, period. Thus, it's completely independent, makes it very easy for us to assess a particular value, and you can spit out some values based upon that very easily. I'd say that's maybe not the most reasonable technical assumption to make, but it's certainly better than, for example, producing your entropy values by statistical testing, for instance. And you know, it'd be nice if that weren't a pressing concern, but in fact, that's like the dominant paradigm in some sense. So we already mentioned that we're interested in having a minimum standard deviation per cycle due to local Gaussian thermal noise. I said that term a whole bunch. Across all of the environmental conditions that we deal with. And that would include any sort of other hardware components that happen to be within the same package. So any accumulated jitter between samples will be less than half the length of the period. That's actually pretty easy. Once you know what the standard deviation is, once you know how many times these things cycle around, you can actually test to see how reasonable that assumption is quite readily. We assume that each bucket is equally likely to be sampled from. And again, I sort of argue that on average, that's a reasonable assumption. On individual samples, maybe not the most reasonable, but ultimately you're going to be sampling a whole bunch of these things anyway, so ultimately you're going to explore all the buckets roughly equally, at least for most systems. We're assuming that the jitter originating from local Gaussian thermal noise is independent from sample to sample. We made that assumption fairly implicitly in that the way that we actually combined these things when we added them, the distribution that resulted, that plays into that, or that is a consequence of that. The oscillator has to be sampled at a fixed frequency, F sub S. If you change that frequency, everything else changes. It's basically the same as if you, say, re-architected the thing, relayed it out, something like that. If the underlying characteristics of the thing change, that's gonna hugely affect what your entropy production is. And then we made some assumptions about the near omniscience of our attacker. So there's no uncertainty associated with when the cycle starts, the global elements of the jitter, or the deterministic elements of the jitter. So we only credit uncertainty from local Gaussian thermal noise since the last sample. So let's review our parameters. We have the period of our ring oscillator, which we call T. We had sigma, which was the standard deviation of the per cycle local Gaussian thermal noise induced jitter for that particular ring oscillator. And we had F sub S, which is the sampling frequency. None of those are model characteristics. These are all characteristics that fundamentally do influence, in fact, dictate the entropy production of any particular ring oscillator. And so it's absolutely vital that these things, that any particular evaluation is conditioned on fixed values for these things. If they wander, or if you haven't really assessed a practical minimum, so for example, if you've chosen a period and standard deviation that doesn't produce a minimum min entropy, then this estimate's not going to be right. And then we have a basically model characteristic, which is K, the number of buckets. But as we saw, that isn't hugely important. We saw that we could figure out what the maximal possible value was, and we could choose something that gave us something close to that. All right, so I'm not sure how everyone tends to deal with references on these things. I will say that if you deal with ring oscillators, and if you try and deal with them as entropy sources, these are all really good things to read. These are all excellent papers. It's not just papers that I thought were vaguely supportive of what I was doing. These are, I think, very important papers in figuring out how this works generically. I will also point out that this first paper has a sort of general intent, an evaluation criteria, which is a little bit distinct from what I did here. What I did here is effectively tracking actual time-based jitter. They have a more phase-based approach in that paper. So that's an interesting alternate approach if you're interested in reading through that. All right, and that's about it. Any questions?
Thank you, that's an excellent talk. So some thoughts are going through my head. One of them is what I call integer seeking behavior in ring oscillators, where it would lead to a crack in your shmoo plot if you were doing a shmoo over the behavior of the device. And it's when you are sampling at some frequency, there is an integer, you will pass through integer relationships, but they're nominally infinitely thin lines. But there's this integer-seeking behavior where the noise introduced by the sampling process causes the ring to lock to it. So there's kind of a wide band in your shmoo plot where it's happened to lock to your sampling and suddenly your noise distribution drops to zero. You know how to design circuits, you can do stuff about that, but you certainly should be checking for that as part of the design rather than assuming that this just gives you the answer under all circumstances. I mean, that's the primary thing I'd worry about if you're doing that process.
Yeah, absolutely. So mutual lock-in and entrainment is absolutely a major issue for all of these, and there's a lot of different possible mutual lock-in relationships that can happen, particularly in instances where what I've got here is effectively talking through more or less one ring oscillator, and so you were talking about that ring oscillator coupling with the sampling clock. I'd like to point out that in the instance, it's very common to have multiple ring oscillators in one single system, and you can have basically a combinatorial explosion of possible locking possibilities here. They could be locking to sampling, they could be locking to each other. It's complicated. I will point out, however, that principally is going to be, so you absolutely see these interesting seeking relationships. The underlying local thermal noise isn't hugely impacted by that, but that doesn't change the fact that the bulk properties of the actual thing do kind of steer toward sort of nice integer relationships, which incidentally makes the, for example, the sampling assumption that I made somewhat problematic. It's important that these things remain at least largely uncoupled so they can explore all of the bins equally.
So the other thing, I get this more question for the room, but if you go to your silicon vendor and ask them for what's the local Gaussian noise in your transistor, if you can get them to give you an answer, the answer they give you will be wrong. So the question is, you know, has this ever happened? Has a vendor ever given a Gaussian noise? And then I'll tell you why it's wrong.
I guess in instances that we've seen explicit specifications of these things, it tends to be as a consequence of simulation. The instances that we've seen, instances where we're making literal measurements, it's problematic to assess, and you end up having to just basically guess as to what component ends up looking like local Gaussian noise. The possibility of, you know, the subtracting very closely entwined oscillators is a nice characteristic and gives you something that's nice, somewhat closer to that. You get some contribution of local switching noise because it's not going to be literally the exact same for even very close ring oscillators. But yes, I mean, that's absolutely an issue. Establishing what the parameters are is an issue.
So my concern there is that the properties for the transistors, or the noise properties of the transistors, are understood from simulation models of physics, but those models are developed to produce worst-case values to build RTL simulation timing models. So when you so their idea is to give you the worst case answer for what the noise is, because that noise is bad when you're doing deterministic simulation. So you want to be pessimistic. That's the opposite of what we need for this. We want the lowest, we want a min bound for the Gaussian noise in the transistor, and that ain't it.
Yeah.
So you might want to take it and divide it by some arbitrary factor you've thought of, like 2, just to understand where the number's coming from. If you can get your vendor to give it to you, it's good luck.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so in all of these issues, I guess it's important to sort of note that the main reason that I'm interested in talking through this is that I agree that in order to come up with actually proper physics-based approach to this would be would absolutely sort of proceed in, you'd want a slightly different style of sampling. But I guess I'd like to point out that what we're interested in doing is providing, you know, a reasonable, justifiable approach that looks better from a security standpoint than running things through a set of statistical tests. And so, absolutely, and you know, it's important to make a lot of prudent assumptions in doing these analyses. But it's important to note that the competition is not, the sort of ideal state of things where we understand precisely what all this looks like. It's, oh, well, the other option is shove it through some statistical tests and see what comes out, which is, I think, worse, almost necessarily.
Any more questions? We still have 5 minutes? Okay, if no more questions, then thanks to our speakers. Jason Sen. Okay, T silent. Okay, so it's S E N. Okay, Jason Sen. And you, Michael. Nice meeting you. Michael Powers.
Yep.
Can I move my stuff over if you want? How do you present it together?
Yeah.
Or one after another?
Yeah, we'll go after one another.
You one after another. So you have a bunch of center. Yeah, right next to it. And Mike,
you
will be presenting first.
Jason first.
Yeah. Okay. So altogether, you have 30 minutes?
We haven't recorded it. Hopefully, it might be a little bit short.
Oh, okay, that's fine. So your section is 30 minutes. Okay. I'm not going to call you independently, so all combined. I may give you 5 minutes warning.
Yeah.
That's not the close up date slide. Can we can we put a USB on the other slides only because this is not the most updated?
Oh, this is do you have your USB?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's try.
Let's get that check.
Yeah.
It's a function of C.
So I think on the other side as well. I was just going to delete the other one, but I can't even find it anymore. Whatever. Let's just go with that.
It's kind of the same with some of our guys. We have some people who are just dedicated to the UCC or Forbes stores. Have some guys are hybrid. You know, switch between the two where they're more interested in doing.
And more and more, we kind of have the synergy between the two because now you have to ask them to do the algorithm testing and have the module validated as kind of stepping stones through
them. Yeah, it's nice to have all under one roof to share information.
But if you know how to use those, you can reduce the downtime of the WCAG resource. It's a little bit high kind of requirement on the new guy, so you have to jump into field.
Yeah, that's true.
Have a more comprehensive understanding, cannot just perform.
Yep.
Yeah.
So I think since you will speak first, I'm going to introduce you first.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, that's fine.
So people don't have to switch. Mismatching, okay.